Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun, two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Okay, welcome to the podcast. We're continuing the discussions we had on the last two podcasts about school closures and how people are dealing with it. And I've got two friends on the podcast, John Micton from Luxembourg and Mark Dilworth from Zurich, who are both in tech leadership positions in their schools, international schools. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Good morning, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's a pleasure. So on the last two episodes, we had people from Asia and the Middle East. And this time I wanted to talk to some European people. And we pulled this together kind of last minute. Mark and me were talking. So I sent a quick invite. So I hope people find this useful. I think it's important to say up front that, you know, I think all of us would agree we're not experts on this topic. You know, we're just giving our perspectives. You know, no one is an expert on this. And, you know, you can agree or disagree with our opinions. But I think, you know, everyone is just trying to get through this as best they can right now.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Dan.
So guys, we've got a great response on Twitter and Facebook, a lot of great points to discuss. But before we do that, I think let's just both individually, let's talk about like what we plan, like what did you, because obviously we kind of saw this coming, not for long, but you know, we had a week or two thinking about it. Like what were you planning before? And then let's talk about how the shutdown actually happened. And then we'll come back to how it went afterwards. So but if you want to kick off, Mark, like how was your kind of war room preparation for this? And then how did it actually go down when the school closed?
We have a safety and security team that would meet on a regular basis. And that frequency that they were meeting started increasing, I'd say, to daily from about sometime in February onward. And one of the things that we were looking at was we were looking at a lot of what the fellow colleagues in Asia were doing either to prepare or to react. And I think one of the things that we didn't heed as well as we could have was the piece of advice that we kept on getting from colleagues. It's going to come, the closure is going to come very, very quickly. Do everything that you can in advance.
Just to jump in there, Mark, one thing I've noticed with Asia that's different is, you know, they've got a history, depending on the country, they've got a history of school closure. It's something they're used to more. Like if you take Thailand, for example, they've had flooding, they've had, you know, the red shirt situation, they've had coup, they've had SARS, you know. So I think in Europe, we're not as used to it as schools in Asia are. You know, Hong Kong, they've had a lot of these things as well.
Yeah, definitely. But I think, again, I think one of the things that really has rung true now in hindsight was that we found out that we were going to have to close on a Friday. And we had been planning for the following week to take two PD days. to sort of prepare our staff and faculty for the transition. And because of the closure, we had to sort of take that off the table and change the way that we were doing the training. So we definitely got hit faster than we thought we would have in terms of how quick we were going to have to react.
John, what about you?
So we have a crisis team, and I have this Facebook group, and I was really monitoring that, and more people were posting throughout Asia. And that was a really good venue to kind of get a sense of what it might look like. We were very much tied to the decision by the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Education. We have some dictates from them. We're part of that ecosystem. So after, I would say in February, we got this crisis team together and we'd meet on a regular basis, more in anticipation and just wondering if we were ready. My team and myself, we quite quickly in February got all the teachers to take their laptops back, check the VPN. So we were doing more preparedness, kind of thinking that that's going to happen one day, but we were thinking maybe not right now. So we also were fortunate. We did have a half-day virtual learning simulation. And that we did it on the Wednesday, and that Friday, the Ministry of Education on Thursday night called a suspension of school. So that next Monday, we went virtual. We did not go virtual learning straight away. We gave our community 2 days. We called it a phased implementation. But I think, like Mark, it was very gradual. And I think for us, it was really looking at what Asian schools were doing, reaching out to that professional learning network and taking advantage of the amazing work they had done that kind of helped us understand what are some things that we needed to do, like guidelines and expectations and things like that. So I think we feel very fortunate from the professional learning network that we all have that we got to tap into to kind of guide us as we move forward with this.
Yeah, definitely. And a plug for John's Facebook group, International School Technology Leaders and Digital Coaches. Doesn't really roll off the tongue, John, does it?
It does not. Yeah, anyway, sorry.
Yeah, so how's it gone? Let's jump into, go back to Mark. Like, how do you want to give a high-level strategy of what you're doing in terms of timetabling and technology and things? And how it's going generally? Like, I know we can talk about the personal aspects a bit later.
Well, again, I would echo John's comments. I mean, those professional learning communities that we've been a part of have been invaluable for us to sort of set our schedules, set our policies, set our processes, and then also to get some really fantastic examples of what teachers are doing in this realm of online learning. We also took, we were closed on a Friday, and then we took 2 days, the Monday and the Tuesday, to work with teachers remotely and virtually to get things up and running and transition to the online program. And basically our starting idea was for our middle school and our upper school, we had modified schedules that ran approximately half the day. And so the idea was that the students would still have contact with all of their teachers on a particular day, using a video conferencing tool. And then at our lower school, we try to replicate the morning meeting or the circle time that happens at the beginning of the day. And that's the face-to-face time, if you will, over the video conferencing with the students. We are just over 1 week in, and we've done our first round of feedback. We've sent some feedback out to students this week to get their insights on how it's going and what their perceptions are. And we've also sent similar set of questions out to the parents as well, just to sort of get an idea of where we are right now before we take any steps about changing it.
And the feedback, was it a Google form and was it anonymous? And I'm curious, what kind of questions did you ask in the feedback?
It was a Google form. I'd have to pull up the questions. The student one was anonymous. The parent one, we did ask for details, contact details, so that we could get back in touch with them if need be.
What kind of feedback did you get? Like any kind of high level points that came through?
We tried to be sort of high end. Like, so for example, some of the student questions were around how they feel. Like, are they engaging in their learning? Is it meaningful? Does the check-in structure of how they're meeting face-to-face with their class, does it work for them? Is it clear what the learning goals are? Do they have guidance and support? Do they feel that they know who they can talk to if they have concerns, be it academic or other? And as per usual, the really interesting thing comes back in the comments. So we did ask them to describe aspects of online learning that they've enjoyed or aspects that they found challenging. And testament to our students, they've put a lot of thought into the responses, and they've given us some really good information to dig into. I guess one thing that comes through is that the consistency of the experience across the teachers is a challenge. Not that the teachers aren't all doing a high quality of delivery, but just how they're doing it is different from class to class. So the experience the student has in one class might differ to the next class. How the teacher is explaining the work or using that video conference time differs from the next teacher. How the teacher might be collecting the work or assigning it might differ. So that feeling of the experience is different for each teacher.
Sure. What about you, John? How did it go and how have you been handling things?
So, yeah, I mean, many things. I think, you know, one thing is that we have a lot of similarities with different schools, but each school has its own culture. So implementation was good. It gave everybody some time to breathe. We're working with two platforms only, Seesaw and Schoology. We've really tried to keep things in two baskets and kind of just for ease of not going to many different places. And that seems to be working quite well. You know, there are a lot of technical issues. You know, my team now is working virtually. That we have somebody in Germany, we have some in Belgium, we have some in France. Those kind of logistics have also made it quite challenging. And I think, you know, what's amazing is the resilience of our staff and our students and parents, because this is quite challenging. I think everybody has different dynamics in their home, issues with internet, everything is so different. I think one thing we noticed is that this virtual learning is very, very demanding. It requires a lot of time and work, and it's quite exhausting. And I think that's one thing that's percolated up. I think many things that Mark said, you know, kids are having different experiences. It's high quality education, but the delivery and some of the methodology is different. And I think sometimes that can be challenging for the user. We've done a lot of informal feedback. In Schoology, there's a lot of data that you can pull out, and we've been taking advantage of that and looking at patterns. It's been challenging. I mean, I think what's amazing is everybody showed up to the start and everybody's engaging. But I think it's really demanding, and that demanding is something that we're starting to really look at. You know, the wellness, what does this mean? What could we recalibrate so it doesn't feel so overwhelming? And I think it's just the nature of virtual learning layered with this anxiety of the coronavirus and personal situations. That combination is quite complex and challenging. And I think within that, that's what we're kind of trying to say, okay, how can we help in that complexity?
How have you found your kind of less techie teachers? Like, because I mean, Mark and me were discussing this earlier in the week. Like, it's, you know, if there is kind of one positive thing that's going to come out of this, it's going to be that there's going to be a lot of upskilling of technology, you know, because people kind of have to, you know, like they have to get up to date in using all these tools and, you know, teaching online. Like, have you found that some the less tech savvy teachers have struggled and you've had to do one-on-one check-ins and training and things like that?
So we have four amazing digital learning coaches, and they have a conference room, a meet, and they have office hours, and they've been supporting. I am just absolutely so proud of every teacher in our school because they have all risen to the occasion. Of course, for some that find digital technology a challenge, it's amazing what they've come and the efforts they've put in and how they're delivering it. I think one thing is we've never had such an accelerated learning curve. And, you know, we joke is that, you know, the coronavirus, the silver lining is everybody is really brushing up their tech skills. And I really want to applaud. And not only in our school, I know in many schools, there are a lot of teachers that have had huge learning curves and just the way they've taken that on, that responsibility and delivered. So I think, yes, we've had to support a variety of different skill sets, and we've set up structures with the library team and the digital learning coaches. They're working very hard, a lot of one-to-one, small group. But I think, you know, with that support, people are really engaging with it and taking heed and going with it. So I think, yes, it's been challenging for some people, but everybody's risen to the occasion. And that's a testament to the professionalism of international school educators.
How do you think about, like, it's interesting because I quite often get comments from listeners of the podcast, because obviously it's an international school podcast, but all kinds of people listen, you know. So people say, well, international schools are well funded, you have four tech coaches, you know. How would you, let's say we're talking to like a public school in Chicago who doesn't have any of that, like how can they deal with their teachers with like super limited resources? Like, I mean, it has to be a kind of, I guess, some sort of group training, community helping each other. But I mean, how do you think that looks like for schools that don't have kind of a budget
or all the staff to help, you know, training with teachers? It's not an easy question to answer, but I'm not sure how schools like that should approach this, you know. Obviously, they can look online and get a lot of resources online, but how do you think within their school they should look at things?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that John started with was mentioning how keeping it simple, and they just use two tools. I mean, we're in a similar situation where we have Seesaw at our elementary, and we have Google Classroom that we use across our middle school and our upper school. The price point for Google Classroom is very attractive. It's one of the reasons that we did it. And again, I think from a good practice, if you want to have a better chance at succeeding with this, the simpler the amount of tools in the toolbox that you're starting with, the better the situation you're in. So I think the harder work is not so much the cost. It's really focusing down on a couple of things and spending your time making sure that people know how to use that core set of tools. And I think
if you guys are saying like using Classroom or Schoology, Seesaw, if teachers are using that anyway, then that's the first, like the best tool is the tool you're already using, isn't it? Then the thing they've really got to get is the video that, you know, using tools like we're using now, we're on Hangouts Meet right now. Like that's the thing they've got to, that teachers have to learn. That's the new way of teaching, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But the one thing I think being in Europe is we have GDPR, and that really, you know, there are a lot of amazing free resources being shared amongst that professional learning network that we're all part of. And one thing we quickly realized, there are a lot of tools that we can't use. So for us, the importance of sticking to Seesaw and Schoology and Zoom and some of the things that have been mapped in our GDPR compliant has been really important. And it's been frustrating for some teachers because they're seeing these tools out there that would maybe support them in some of these workflows. So I think, you know, as Mark is saying, trying to make it as simple as possible. And what you said, Dan, is that if you have a tool that people are familiar with, then focus on that. I think bringing on new tools can be quite challenging. So we've really been working with the staff community and understanding that and supporting them with a small package of tools. But we feel that with that, we can deliver quality virtual learning. But I think it's really important to be careful adding new things last minute, because I think that makes it quite complicated, not only for the tech department that has to set these up and the digital learning coaches and library teams that have to support, but then the teachers that have to engage with it. So I think really trying to, as Mark said, keep it as simple as possible and try to have a small basket of tools.
And something you mentioned, like don't reinvent the wheel. I mean, a lot of people online acting like, you know, virtual learning is a new thing, but it's not. You know, I'm taking a postgraduate course at the University of Nottingham now, which is completely online. There's virtual school districts that have been there for a long time. You know, there's multiple online school districts, multiple degree programs. I mean, like people have learned how to do this effectively. You know, it's not a new thing. It's the trick is finding the right resources to show you how to do it effectively. You know.
I mean, I think our teachers have been working, I would say, almost harder than they were when they were in the classroom, because they are having to learn a different way of delivery. So, you know, they can't interact with the students in the same way. They can't give the information over in the same way. They can't check in the students in the same way. So they're spending a lot of time going back to their planning and really flipping what they've done before. And that's, I think, what's taking a lot of time, and where we're getting a lot of the, I guess, the effort on supporting the teachers is not so much with the technology, but more, how do I translate what I did before in a meaningful way and a much more measured way to this new format, this new paradigm? And that's where we're finding a lot of the work and a lot of the time and a lot of the effort has been going into this last week, and I think will still continue for the next couple of weeks as we get used to this new paradigm.
Yep. Building on what Mark is saying, I think also the idea of teams, really working as teams, you know, in teaching often in any team you have people that like to maybe work more independently, but I think what we're noticing is the teams that are really working together, supporting each other, because in every school, there are cases where maybe a staff member is sick, or there are some dynamics at home and they can't actually support the learning because of a personal situation. So the teaming becomes very important, and the team basically using one template and one pedagogical vehicle to really push that learning out instead of everybody doing it on their own. And I think you really have so much more support, and it's much more robust if you go with a team approach. That's something that I would, you know, suggest as something to really work with and highlight for schools that are facing this soon, is to really leverage your teams, your team leaders, your department heads, really working with them to support each other.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Dan, you're still muted there.
Yeah, I was on mute. A very professional podcaster here. Okay, guys. So what we're going to do now is, if you're okay, we're going to jump in and look at some questions, starting off with some questions on John's Facebook group, and then we'll look at Twitter as well. So let's do it, guys. So the first one here, and guys, if give us our opinion. Obviously, like I said before, we're not experts, and maybe we don't know the answer to these things. Duncan Ogilvy asks, how do you and have you supported and educated staff in moving to an online pedagogy? How much emphasis have you placed in instructional design? And how does this come in phases? And what has your strategy been? That's a lot of questions, I guess. So let's break it down. How have you supported staff in moving to online pedagogy? And how much emphasis on instructional design?
So in our case, our teams have really taken that on. So it's been a team approach. They've been meeting and working together and trying to adapt as they go. The reality is that it was so sudden, this move, that there wasn't really preamble. And the idea is, as Mark, I think, put a very important point, is virtual learning is not like face-to-face learning. And it's a new methodology. It's a new way of delivery. And I think, you know, with the accelerated move to virtual learning, many of those things, there was not the time and space. So right now, I think what is happening is teams are talking to each other, getting feedback, and adapting as they go.
Celeste, yeah. Oh, sorry, Mark, have you got something to say?
No, I mean, I think we had a lot of plans on that we had been building up based on what we'd seen from colleagues. And we knew that two things in particular. One was how we prepare teachers for designing instruction for this different format. And the other one was the social emotional support of students and of teachers. And so we tried to do a lot of that by building into the teams that were working. Ability to check in on all employees and all faculty, that somebody had someone to talk to, even if for what they were doing for their instructional design, they were working alone, they had someone that they were paired with or teamed with to check in and see how they were doing.
Celeste Coronado asks, how do you do summative assessments for K-12? And we've got a related question from Ryan McKinney. Piggybacking on summative assessments, what proctoring methods can be implemented digitally? So guys, summative assessments, proctoring, any feedback on this?
Well, AP has that the AP browser or the special browser for some of their exams. Yep. But I think one of the challenges that we're facing is that we're one to one, and we do give out the devices. We provide them to our students, but our setup is not set up to remotely administer the devices off campus. So that we rely on having them come back in on the network. So we're having to work out new ways. If we were going to be able to restrict computer access for a user, we're still trying to work out what's the best way, what are the needs that we would have for that, and what would be the best way to achieve that, given that we can't bring everybody in.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, if you administer Chromebooks, you can put them into kiosk mode and things like that. Yeah. There's ways to do that. But I mean, you know, this is if you're not already doing this within your school environment, it's kind of hard to go straight into doing this on a remote environment when your students are not in school, you know.
I mean, our teachers currently are writing report cards, believe it or not. And I think that they're doing the best with the methodologies that they had done previously. And of course, there are gaps and challenges with it. But at this stage, because of, as I said before, this accelerated switch, I think we're just trying to work with what systems we already have and methodologies and doing the best. It's very likely not ideal, but they're all busy writing report cards and doing the best they can within the circumstances.
Definitely.
We had a good situation with our English department at the upper school where one of their summative assessments was basically a student came in and talked through their portfolio and that made the basis for one of their final assessments. And they're able to do that style of assessment remotely. And so what some of the other departments are looking at is how can we have that sort of summative assessment where I'm not asking them to fill out answers that could be searched elsewhere, that I'm getting them to explain their understanding in a way that I can assess it, I can determine where they are. So it's really challenging how some departments have traditionally done assessment.
Yep.
Now, I've heard some schools really going with a project-based learning as a tool for summative assessment, where there's a project and then the kid through video conferencing, as Mark says. So I think, you know, so one thing is that project-based learning and that kind of pedagogy obviously lends itself maybe more to this virtual learning environment.
Definitely. So Craig Wehrle, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I don't know if you saw it. He posted the longest post ever. It's really impressive. Like, it must have taken him a long time. But the gist of it is, what are your strategies for managing subscription requests? And what he's talking about is, you know, staff are saying, I need Zoom. I need a Zoom license. I need this. Like, obviously, you guys have said you're trying to stick with what you're already using. But how do you think? Because he's talking about, like, you know, if he agreed to all these things, he would get rid of his whole budget for subscriptions in a few weeks, you know. But teachers want to try some tools, you know, and some schools are being flexible in letting individual staff, you know, choose a tool that works for them. So what's your view on managing requests for subscription for software earnings?
We're being very strict in the sense we're trying to. Part of the problem is when you adopt these new subscriptions, somebody has to check them. Sometimes they have to be set up, and that's more workflows for the IT library team. So we've really tried to stick to what we have. The one thing we did do was Screencastify, because it integrates nicely with Chrome. So we talked to them. We're also working with Zoom, that's GDPR compliant. So we're being very cautious, and maybe I appreciate that there very likely is some frustration because of that, but we are not adopting a single thing without mapping it and then our DPO approving it. So that obviously doesn't give us the flexibility to grab whatever and be more open-ended, but I think we feel very committed to that process because we have to abide by that.
Yeah, we're taking a similar approach. I think what we've tried to do is we've tried to distinguish between a service that has become free where they're giving access to resources versus a service where you're registering the students and you're having to submit student details to access the service. And we've had a couple of those, and we're also wary of some of the phishing attempts that are happening through the guise of some of these services. So what we've really tried to do is ask people to be vigilant and look at what it is, to seek one of our tech coaches and pass the information on to them and get their help to access the resources. Or if we already have a tool that does that we can steer them back towards, again, something that we already have.
Yeah, I mean, if I look to the end of Craig's post, he says, if I met every request for a subscription for this hopefully short-term crisis, the cost would be one third of my budget. Or was my strategy of suggesting to use the tools currently available and consider any others as part of a long-term plan better? So I think we're saying his plan is probably the best. You stick with the tools he's already using, and other things we'll consider long-term, but it's just too hard to bring them in this time. Great question from Rafael Ribas. He says, perhaps a question looking positively at the future, how do you think these strategies that have been developed now will affect pedagogy and the use of edtech when we get back to teaching in school?
I think they'll have a fantastic impact on how teachers are using the tools. I mean, we were already using Seesaw and Classroom to deliver some of the content. I think what we'll see, and what we're certainly seeing at schools that have been out for a longer time, is that the curated content that they're producing to do synchronous and asynchronous teaching online is fantastic. So the content that everybody is creating, the things that they're developing in terms of how they're working with students, I think we'll just see that pass over right back into the classroom, and that you'll see a lot better, I guess, delivery of information, a lot sleeker use of the tools as a result.
Yeah, I agree with Mark. I think we're going to see people amplifying the tools in very different ways that they didn't, and bringing that into the classroom. So I think people are really, you know, with it, as Seesaw was mentioned in Schoology, we're seeing teachers use it in ways that we maybe hadn't thought of the potential, and we're really pushing it out of the box, which is amazing. So I think a lot of that will percolate over when we come back face to face. And as Mark says, the wealth of curated content that people will be able to tap into, you know, on all these professional learning networks will be phenomenal.
Yeah, great points, guys. Stephanie Zexa mentions How do we ease the strain on homeroom teachers? I guess this is more a point, and she asks about distribution of teaching in primary schools, but I mean, how do we ease the strain? Because obviously there's a lot of pressures on staff. Any ideas from you guys how you've dealt with that?
I think wellness and well-being are so important. And I think that's something that from what I'm reading and talking to people in the professional learning networks is that has become now the big issue. How do you rebalance and recalibrate? How do you make sure that teachers are not feeling overwhelmed? And I think one thing that I often hear is cut everything by a third or cut everything by a half. So the content that you're delivering, cut away a third or a half to lessen that. Because I think sometimes in the enthusiasm, we want to give a lot because we think if there's a lot, that gives a sense that we're doing a good job. And I think there's some truth to that, but also being able to less is more. How can we support teachers and parents to understand less is more and giving that space? Because it is very demanding being in a room. You have two kids, your husband or wife is working too, and you're juggling that. So I think the wellness is a really important topic. So for homeroom teachers, it's helping them and seeing how we can maybe deliver less, but still have that rich quality.
Yeah, I think that the teaming aspect that John mentioned earlier, that's been really important to help our homeroom teachers. Again, we're only a week and a half in, but we're constantly looking at how can we sort of support what they're doing and sort of take some of that load and share it out. So we have more than one class per grade level at our lower school. And so they're doing a great job. They have a fantastic teaming structure to begin with. And I'm getting to experience it as my daughter is in one of the elementary grades. And, you know, she's the content that she's accessing to go throughout her day isn't just made by her homeroom teacher. It's made by all the homeroom teachers at the grade level. So they've done a fantastic job of dividing that out and taking responsibility for different aspects or different concepts within the day. I think the other thing is that we've also added to the teams those teachers who are not homeroom teachers to have an active role, either to if they're a specialist teacher that they have a certain portion of the week that they are responsible for or that they team teach with the homeroom teacher. And so those have been, I think, two things that we've worked on to lighten the load so that it's not just the homeroom teacher that's carrying everything.
Couple of questions regarding teaching specifically. Myron Buck asks, the challenges of getting authentic nonverbal feedback from kids through the digital medium. As teachers, we usually can gauge how they understand things from facial expressions, behaviors, etc. But all these are absent in an online situation, especially if they keep their cameras off. I think that's one problem. And don't open emails. So anything here, guys, about the challenges of getting nonverbal feedback when you're teaching online?
Well, I think one thing, yeah, of course, the video in Schoology, we have this thing called conferencing where kids can come in and their rooms and there's a whiteboard and they can turn on and off their cameras, put their hand up. So that's one thing that people are starting to use. And, you know, yeah, if a kid doesn't turn on their camera, it's hard. I think also just reaching out to kids, you know, our counseling team has really been working hard to make sure that if kids fall through the cracks or absent, that they're, you know, somebody's out there checking in with them. I think that's important. I mean, discussion boards might be another way, but I think, yeah, I think we need to realize that there's some things we get to do face to face we won't be able to do in the online world. We can try to replicate it to a certain level, but it's different. And I think that is you know, something that we have to live with and look for creative ways around it, but I don't think we'll ever replicate that facial expression in the classroom.
I think some of the feedback or some of the really positive feedback that we've just seen in the last couple of days has been from teachers who just make the effort to reach out to the students beyond the expected time, making sure that students know that they're available.
Yeah.
And again, that won't work for every teacher and that won't work for every student, but where we are getting some positive feedback are those ones that sort of go above and beyond what's expected of them and make themselves available and really put the emphasis or put their focus not on the delivery of content, but the delivery of, are you okay? Do you need anything?
Yeah. Related question from Charlotte Blessing, how to draw in on the more quiet students who don't add comments in the chat box or speak up?
Yeah, I think what Mark was sharing is definitely the best way, where you reach out to those kids as best as you can. And it's amazing what our teachers are doing around the world to make sure there is that sense of community and connecting. And even maybe, you know, depending the situation, reaching out to the parent, if appropriate. I think, you know, it is what, however you can get, give that sense of community. And I think, as Mark was saying in his primary school, they were using the morning check-ins, you know, these check-ins where kids just come into a room and get to hang out for a few minutes and, you know, see each other. I think that can be very important. It's whatever you can do to embed those type of wellness and, you know, community building aspects, whatever medium you're using, I think really do benefit in getting maybe the quieter kids to participate. I don't know, Mark, if you guys are doing anything else.
I mean, I couldn't come up with a specific strategy other than what you would try and use in the classroom, although not having the visual connection, you might not be able to notice as much. But I mean, we've tried to maintain our student support processes. In terms of, you know, our grade level teams are still coming together and meeting and talking about students of concern. So we've tracked attendance in the sense that, you know, are people checking in? Not are they there the whole lesson? And if someone's not there throughout the week, the teacher will reach out to that student, or they will escalate that and bring that to the student support team and the counselors and say, can you check in with the student and the families, make sure everything's okay? I mean, maybe they were traveling, or maybe the internet was down or what have you, and they didn't check in. But we've tried to keep in those processes so that we aren't forgetting someone, or we're not noticing someone.
Yeah, great points, guys. Rob McElroy, shout out to Rob in South Korea, asks, Zoom privacy concerns have been popping up in the news. How real is the concern? Any opinions on this, guys? Mark and me talked about this a little bit before the podcast. Definitely, we're not experts on this topic.
Definitely not an expert, but just working with Zoom and having mapped it and looking at their GDPR compliance and everything, one thing we are moving forward with it, but it's only with teachers' use. We are not giving kids accounts or anything like that. And we're trying the most... pretty much whenever we can, we're asking our staff to use the Schoology conferencing, which is a closed room. Only kids that are logged into the class can participate in the video. And if you record it, itself deletes after a certain period of time and all the data with it. So that's what we're really, you know, if there are other tools, I mean, I think Zoom has suddenly become very prominent because this whole free thing, and it is a very robust program. I think with anything that you decide to adopt, it's well worth spending the extra time to make sure that the privacy settings, the privacy statements fit with what your expectations are and what your community is willing to live with. I think it's really hard to make blanket statements, but I think it's really important that whenever you adopt a new tool, that you're really clear what are the privacy, how are the settings set it up, how does it work, what powers people have, and really kind of think about that and then decide within the culture and your school community, is this something that we can live in and does it make sense?
Great. Dale Plotsky. Dale's in Peru. Great guy, actually. I went surfing with him when I was across at the Running Our Summit in Lima. He says, all-star cast. So thanks. He's getting off to a good foot by complimenting the hosts. I like that. Ask them, what are some of the sacred cows in education that realistically need to be let go of in this situation? Oh, a very good question. What are some of the sacred cows that we need to get rid of? I've got one. I mean, I think that, like, you know, people can't say that you can't teach online. I mean, you can say it's difficult, but, you know, you can't, you know, it can be done. I think, you know, like, if you can do it, you know, people have, like I said, people have been teaching in online school districts before. You know, it's not easy and it needs a lot of support, but it can be done. That would be my one. Anything for you guys to add?
I mean, I think it's really hard right now because of the point we are in the year, that there is a very real need to get through some of the content. In order to prepare some of our graduating students to get them where they need to go. And I think it's really hard because the best thing to do right now is to take the time to establish the new routines so that you can effectively use these tools. So if you're not ready to operate in this environment, you're gonna have to sacrifice the ability to push content for the ability to use this new medium. As a means to deliver the content that you've got to deliver. I don't think it's something you can sacrifice, because there is a real need and there is a timeline that the students are working towards as well. But if you can't take the time to establish the routines and the understanding of how to do the curriculum instruction and design for this medium, you might be doing your students more of a disservice.
I think the other thing is you have to work as a team. You can't be an individual teacher working off on your own. I think that for me is what the, you know, groups that work closely together and support each other, check in on each other, will be more resilient.
Yes, I would definitely agree. How, just to come back to the point Mark mentioned, like, how are you guys dealing with, because obviously this is kind of tough on students that are graduating, this is their year. Are you guys IB primarily for your, or are you doing any other curriculums? And how has that been handled in terms of your assessments? I know IB is doing predictive grades. Are you doing any other situations, any other curriculums?
So we just found out, I think it was last week or this week even, that the IB has decided not to do the IB exams, and we are an IGCSE school, and they've done the same. So the Academic Council, which is a group of upper school staff leaders, that are now really grappling with this. What does this mean now that there is actually no IB exam? That is, and you know, for a lot of kids, that's a very important moment. And then there's graduation. You know, are we doing a virtual graduation? All those things right now are being discussed, you know, by our upper school teams and the leadership team, is what do we do now that these important moments in a child's career, is that graduation, the IB exam, those are, you know, community moments of celebration and acknowledgement of work that's been done. So we're right now with this new reality kind of talking to each other and say, okay, what are we going to do?
Yeah, and I think we're in a very similar spot. And in fact, I would say that topic would make an exceptional podcast if you got the right people.
Yes, I would definitely get some IB people and the IBO maybe even. I think this is very challenging. And I think for, you know, you have these celebrations. And I think when you leave high school, it's one of those critical moments in your life. You're leaving school, going off to university, and for IB schools, the IB exam and the community that builds around that, and then the graduation, the end of year trips, all those things, you know, are so important for kids, and they look forward to it and they become part of the culture of your school. And now that this can't happen, I think this is a huge challenge for schools, is how do we, you know, deliver this and still give that sense of community, even though we don't have this face-to-face contact. And I echo Mark. A good topic for you, Dan, for the next podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Any listeners, IB people, get in touch. And you guys, if you're anyone you can recommend, it's interesting. You know, I think the problem is, I think Mark mentioned it, you know, a lot of principals would be great, but a lot of them just don't have the time to do this kind of podcast. But yeah, great points. So, like, final question. We've got through everything, actually, which was fantastic. David Slattery asks, how close are schools sticking to their normal curriculum in terms of content and timetable?
I think that depends on the school, that where you are, the way you've set things up. I don't think there is a blanket, you know, way of doing it. I think, you know, through the conversations I've had with Mark offline, and I feel that, you know, the content, it's, you can't deliver what you delivered face to face. It's just not going to happen. It's very, very hard to. And I think it's about recalibrating and maybe re-agreeing to some new expectations. I think, you know, as we're at the beginning of this journey, I think we're still trying to grapple with what is too much, what is not enough. And yes, the content is important, but you know, how much is realistic? And especially depending how you deliver the content in a face-to-face classroom, how do you replicate that effectively and meaningfully in a virtual world? So I think it's very tough to kind of give a blanket statement. I think every school has to grapple with that, considering the dynamics of their staff and the way they set themselves up and the expectations of the community.
Yeah, I think it can't be your primary driver in this transition. I think your primary goal has to be, am I taking care of my colleagues? Am I taking care of my students? And if you get that right, then your ability to get through more of the content than you could have will be much higher.
Definitely. Well, guys, great place to finish. Pleasure to talk to you as always. And again, I look forward to catch up. Let's maybe jump on another episode in 2 or 3 weeks and see how things are progressing. Hopefully, we'll be thinking about going back to school, but who knows? Could be getting worse. Hopefully.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, thank you. Look forward to that. Cheers. Have a good day, guys.
Thank you.